Tom Chick, and you're listening to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast. I am here with Christian Mistowski. Christian Mistowski.
I prefer to be called the Ginger Midget.
Very good. We also have with us Kelly Wand.
You were right, that was Lane. Oh, wait, that's not my catchphrase. Are you ready for the catchphrase?
Yeah, do you have a catchphrase for us this week?
Yeah.
By the way, do your catchphrase. What is your catchphrase?
I'm not going to do big, long, stupid ones anymore. I'm going to do short, stupid ones. This week says, the mind is a terrible thing.
Aha, I like how you stopped and you defied expectation there. Just cut off. Very good. Very
delivery.
Good.
Well, I'm a professionally trained podcaster.
What movie should we talk about this week? Kelly Wan, do you have any ideas? Because I'm sure there's something you're keen to talk about.
I had plenty more to say about Avatar, because I don't think people in Quarter 3 had heard enough about what we thought about Avatar. I think they wanted another 3 hours, so go with the movie, and they could listen to the podcast while they watch the movie again.
We could have gone and seen it a second time to see if any of our opinions changed, but I think it's time to move on. There are other crappy movies to see, and I think we stumbled.
Spoiler alert.
Oh, but then...
That's a big reveal by your... Ooh.
Well, just so you know, stop listening if you have not seen Sherlock Holmes, specifically the one directed by Guy Ritchie.
Just keep listening and don't see the movie. Spoiler alert.
Well, we will be spoiling. We're assuming you have seen it. If you haven't seen it, you should bail now, or, you know, you've been warned. We're going to assume that you have seen it. So I think, Dingus, why don't you lay some cards on the table real quick?
No, I had to do that first last week, and I got beat up.
Well, we've already laid cards on the table. I mean, I already said something about crappy movies. We know Kelly Wand. I am eager to do this podcast just because I want to listen to Kelly Wand talk about how awful the movie was.
All right. Well, no, okay. So let me just say... Okay,
well, I want to find out if we're going to offend Christian again, because he was so into Avatar last week, I felt bad that we were, like, throwing cold water on him for the hour.
I think Avatar's worth seeing, just for the record.
No, you don't.
Yeah, it's worth seeing. It's just not worth listening to. Just go in and don't listen to it.
Ah, well...
You'll love it. But you didn't even think that. You called it ugly.
I did, yes.
Well, let's get back to our 1890s nightmare.
Christian will say that there was a lot in Sherlock Holmes that I liked, but overall I just felt like I'd been beat up after watching it.
Well, your reaction then was stronger than mine, because I didn't even feel beat up. I just that movie was in one ear and out the other for me. It had very little impact on me. It felt so insubstantial, I have to say.
Then I liked it most, because I went in wanting to murder it.
Right.
I felt extremely hostile towards this whole movie, except for the prospect of Rachel McAdams and Fishnets, which they cut. The one thing that I was looking forward to seeing, they cut. But then I found myself kind of enjoying chunks of it for the first half, like little bits, like lines in and of themselves that I thought were kind of cute.
Well, that's disappointing, because I was looking forward to just unbridled hostility from you this week, Kelly Wand.
I think I was trying to go the other way, because you were the one who talked me into, because I felt... What's your definition of an adaptation? What do you consider?
I think anything that's not drawn from original material, anything that is derived from other material.
All right, let me rephrase that. What do you consider the basis of a successful adaptation, a film adaptation of other material?
Well, there you go. Successful depends on what you're looking for from an adaptation.
And I have to say, satisfied.
But here's what I'm looking for from an adaptation. You ready? Yeah. Nothing whatsoever. I am perfectly fine with different adaptations coming from different perspectives, some being reverent to the material, some completely throwing it out the window. So I had no stakes in this being based on Arthur Conan Doyle's stories.
See, I tried to do that, because I think you're wrong, but I knew that ship had sailed in this instance. And, you know, I think, okay, my answer would have been that an adaptation somehow captured the essence of something, like Lord of the Rings kind of captured the essence of the books in a geographical way.
Okay.
Even if it made a bunch of deviations. And so this, I knew, I could tell from the first instant, wasn't going to be anything like the Arthur Conan Doyle stuff. So I sort of parked that away. Okay. I took your advice.
Good.
And went, all right, forget it. It's just what it is. It's not, let's just forget about Arthur Conan Doyle and my affection and my whole take on that. And then it still doesn't work. It's not a good movie. These characters don't make any sense, and I left soured and scowly and Kelly Wandy.
But not as angry as you had been if you had gone in expecting it to better capture the essence of Arthur Conan Doyle. Right?
Right.
Okay.
Because there's, I can be bought by cute little lines, and there's some funny Holmes lines. It's just crappy characterization. Like, their relationship just doesn't make any sense to me. They're just quarreling all the time through the movie. There's no arc. And they're all smarty, sassy wiseacres, both of them. And she is, too, Rachel McAdams. There's no one normal to play off of. It's like, yeah, sorry, I'm just rambling.
I want to ask you a question, Kelly. I'm not sure what you're saying here about the adaptation. If you don't like what they tried to do with the interpretation, or you don't like it because it's a crappy movie. In other words, if he had made a decent movie where Sherlock Holmes was an action kick-ass dude, would that have been okay? But is it just because he made a crappy movie, or is it because of what he was going for?
It's because he made a crappy movie. I was willing to, like, I guess that's what I was saying poorly, was I went in expecting to hate it as an adaptation. And then it was so far, I knew it wasn't going to be an adaptation, so I just tried to look at it as a movie. And then for the first half, I wasn't hating it as much as I thought.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to sound condescending, and I'm half serious, but I'm very proud of you, Kelly Wand.
I probably can't do it again.
Okay. That's all you've got in you. Okay.
But the point at which the movie jumps the shark for me is where the pork factory explodes. And there's all this slow-mo and tragic music, and there's the sense you think they're setting up that Watson's dead or something.
Yep, yep.
And then he's in the hospital for
surgery,
these wounds. And then Holmes blacks out, and then when he wakes up, they're all back in the room again, like them and her. And Watson's not wounded, and then they go, okay, so what's our next thing? And what was the point of all that? Why are they?
Boy, you hung with it for a long time.
I was trying. I was really trying because I wanted to be the rebel this time. I was like, God, Sherlock Holmes is great. But...
So you were fine through that whole ship set piece?
I wasn't fine, but I was liking the cinematography, and I kind of liked – there was more evocative period piece music than I was expecting. I thought it was going to be all indie rock for some reason. So the fact that they had little Irish sea shanties during the boxing match, was like, oh, this is all right. This is acceptable entertainment. In a biodome kind of way. But then, I don't know. What do you guys think of the action scenes? And there's a ton of them.
Well, by the way, I just want to say that for the DVD cover, this is acceptable entertainment is going to be the catch. I think that's the perfect quote.
Oh, that's what they wanted.
Dingus, where did it – so Kelly Wand, you felt it jump the shark with that sloppy bit where they're like, hey, Watson is dead. And I actually thought – this is really brave. They're going to kill
Watson. I know. I thought that, too. I go, Watson. This is a great movie.
Exactly. I was so ready to admire that choice. And then I just felt stupid.
Right.
So, Dingus, did it start to lose you anywhere? You mentioned the ship set piece, the fight around the base of the ship being constructed. You didn't like that?
No, I did not like that at all.
What was wrong with it? And go ahead. Talk a little bit about that.
It felt completely just a cursory special effects set piece. It felt like we have to run away from this action scene, this fighting scene. Quick, we have to run over to this other soundstage. And there's no reason to have this. It was so weird. There was no reason to have this huge, gigantic ship set piece, and it was all beautiful looking in its way, I suppose. But I just felt like as it was all happening, why are we here and why are we doing this? And later on, what I felt like with the power we now have, you can put anything in that scene in the background and make any gigantic thing be going on. And it doesn't have to do with the context of the film whatsoever. You could put a spaceship in that room and they could do the same actions. You could put a gigantic robot that they're building in that room and have the same actions. Nothing that's going on in there has anything to do with the film. We just felt like running over to a warehouse, knocking something over and having some giant things fly at them.
Okay.
And it has nothing to do with anything else. It felt, as I was watching it, I thought, why are we here?
Now, can I answer that?
And there were no consequences to that.
I actually have an answer for that, Dingus. I think
go ahead.
I quite enjoyed that set piece. And that, to me, was the peak of the movie, and that is where I wish the movie had been a little smarter, because I know why we were there. And I think the reason why we were there is actually pretty cool, and I suspect somewhere from one of the 12 screenwriters who wrote this movie, this, what I'm about to explain, was a movie.
Hold on. Kelly's crawling up from under his bed again.
The reason we're there isn't just because it looks cool. That's the main reason, and that is ultimately why it was included in the movie. But one of the things that I really liked about this movie, and would have liked if the movie had been a little bit more aware of it, was this idea of the theme of the British Empire, and Sherlock Holmes being a fixture of the British Empire, the British Empire being this huge naval entity, you know, that controlled the seas. And so naturally, Sherlock Holmes is going to have a conflict where the British Empire is projecting its power out across the world. You know, the villains, he was this 19th century neoconservative. You know, he wanted to bring America back into the British Empire. So I love the idea that, he wanted to conquer America.
Who did?
The main villain did.
Blackwell.
Okay. Blackwell. So there's an idea. They're the kernel for these ideas of cool political concepts. You know, Sherlock Holmes is so English, and the movie, at times, is also so English. I loved the fact that they acknowledge that America is now weak from the Civil War. You know, they tie it into this historical context. I love that they talk about
in a Wild Wild West kind of way. Maybe.
Exactly, and I almost was expecting a giant mechanical spider at the end or something. So that dingus, I think, at some point in the script, I bet was part of why they were at this shipyard. But it ultimately just became a throwaway set piece. Wouldn't it be cool if they knock over a giant ship?
So that makes sense if I'd had any sense of those surrounding concepts. But it felt like, right, let's run over into a warehouse that is full of fireworks.
Right. And I agree that, what I was just talking about is probably equal parts my projection, another third, that's one third of it is maybe some idea that a script writer might have had or not, but then it's totally lost and it's just there because it's supposed to look cool.
Wait, so you're agreeing with them after all that? This is great stuff for the pitch meeting, by the way, everything you're saying. It's an allegory for the British Empire. Guy Ritchie's a genius, and so is Simon Kinberg.
Well, there wasn't a lot of that in the movie, though. I mean, that wasn't a strong subtext. And so that was one of the reasons that I only liked that scene. That was the only memorable action piece for me.
Now, that's not when the movie started to go sour for me. I started to get weird feelings earlier than that. But where did you have a specific moment where you said, uh-oh, Tom?
I think early on, like watching them make this he was a super smart, almost medically aware superhero boxer. You know, when early on, when they do that flash forward thing, I was like, okay, this is a cool concept, but okay, this isn't the Sherlock Holmes I'm really expecting. If they want to do that, all right, let's see.
It's Robert Downey doing his Iron Man. It's the exact same guy.
Well, that's
much.
So what I've got at the top of my notes is, whose fault is it that the movie Sherlock Holmes is so engaging? Because this is what I was wondering as I was watching it. Who do I blame for the fact that this movie wasn't as good as it could have been and should have been?
Did you say whose fault is it that it was so engaging or
was unengaging?
So unengaging. Okay.
And amongst the people to whom I assign blame, I actually put Guy Ritchie near the bottom. I kind of feel like he got the shaft here. But Robert Downey Jr. gets a lot of the blame for it. And it's like you said, Kelly Wand, he's so contemporary in this movie, and it really hurts it, I think.
And he's doing the exact same shtick he did in Iron Man.
Yeah.
He's doing that, oh, I'm looking bewildered, but I'm actually a genius. And there's these quick passages I'll just rush through to prove.
Oh, my God, no kidding. I mean, I couldn't. His delivery was just terrible.
Well, I think
he looked bored. You can't hear a word he's saying. Yeah, a little bit. He looked tired.
Yeah, he's tired and bored.
But he's supposed to be strung out on drugs and eye surgery, laudanum.
I noticed they did, you know, a quick nod to the fact that he was abusing various substances.
I like that. I'll give him that. And he did smoke a pipe, for God's sake.
Deer stalker, deer killer? What is that?
That's
deer
all right. Stalker. That's not from the books necessarily, so I'm cool with that. But I ask a stupid question. Oh, never mind.
I was going to ask you, I want to know your stupid question, but I did feel they got a lot of mileage out of, I felt like a lot of the movie was, let's throw a cool costume on Robert Downey Jr. You know?
And take his shirt off.
And take his shirt off and give him when they're investigating the Lord Blackwood's grave, you know, he's got his cool hat and cape and his John Lennon glasses and his, the detective kit that unfolds in front of his crotch like a big old Sherlock Holmes penis. All of that was, I could just see a costume.
But he never does anything with, like, Watson kicks the door down.
Well, that's right. All of that is just for lockpicks.
Yeah, Holmes is an idiot throughout this movie. Irene drugs him, and he's just always getting his ass handed to him. It's weird.
So, but I blame Robert Downey Jr. for a lot of it, and also the script. I just thought the script was just a huge...
Name the writers, so everyone knows who they are, besides Simon Kinberg, who Jumper, incidentally.
About that.
And it had a Jumper ending where they go, oh yeah, we're going to Moriarty something, basic plot point. Now you have to see a whole sequel. We'll just fix it later.
Well, I realized I was kind of glad we weren't going to get an origins story. I was a little sad that we started sort of in media res with the relationship between Holmes.
I disagree.
But it became an origin story for Professor Moriarty, I realized. This is the little prelude. You know, they want this to be the prequel for a franchise. I mean, that's clear as you're watching it.
Yeah.
That's made so painfully clear.
Oh, what part of the machine did he steal? Oh, I can't wait to find that out.
It's the transistor. It's the radio transmitter thing.
I mean, so there's going to be another big machine finale in the next one?
It'll control the mechanical spider in Wild Wild West.
I cared how these two dudes met because they seemed to quarrel so often and had seemed to work together so poorly. I really would have wanted to see when times were good just to believe in it.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Do you mean Holmes and Watson? I liked their chemistry. Did you not like their chemistry?
They were like that the whole movie. They were always bickering. And even at the end, I go, are they still working together? I mean, okay, is he moving out still when he cuts him down? I couldn't figure out if things were still on or not, or Mrs. Watson was going to let them party together.
Well, it's like you said before, Kelly Wand, there's really no arc. I mean, their relationship doesn't change.
No, for any of them.
It's pretty one note throughout the movie.
And the Rachel McAdams character, we're told she has duped him twice already. And then in this, she drugs him, steals his clothes, which I didn't understand.
That was so you could get to that line about, you know, the key to my release is under
right.
The...
How do you make Rachel McAdams uninteresting?
It takes a lot of work, Dingus. They really had to work on that.
He was just so bored with her, and he was supposed to be fascinated by her. He was really more interested in Watson. You could just feel Robert Downey Jr. sort of trying to be interested in her, but he was really ultimately just bored by her. And she was – I love her, and she was just completely uninteresting. How do you do that?
Now, what do you love her from, Dingus? Because she doesn't register for me. I know you've mentioned her several times when we've talked. Like, what makes you love Rachel McAdams?
The thing I really felt for her was in this Canadian BBC miniseries about a Shakespeare group in Canada. I can't even remember the name of it.
Is this Slings and Arrows?
Slings and Arrows, thank you very much. She was wonderful, and this is before she was a star. She was just luminous. And I also really, really liked her in, I think it was Wedding Crashers. I liked her a lot.
Ah, right.
And in this, she just nothing. It just like she just had to project an attitude or something.
That's the writing, though. That's not her fault.
Well, I'm not blaming her. I'm not blaming her. My question is, how do you make her uninteresting when to me she shines, and she just did in this.
Yeah.
She just, and part of it is that Holmes. There's clearly no chemistry between the two of them.
Yeah, I mean, think of, for instance,
what we're supposed to believe.
Yeah, I think of Gwyneth Paltrow and Robert Downey Jr. in the Iron Man movie, which I wasn't that crazy about, and I also thought was similarly sort of flat writing. But there's chemistry between them. I mean, their relationship has real sparks in it. There, I thought. And I didn't see any of that in this movie with Rachel McAdams.
Well, what I was thinking, and what it was something actually you had said earlier about a movie called Duplicity, because when he's following her and he slaps on a disguise real quick and follows after her and he's going through the market and everything, I was thinking of the moments when Clive Owen is following Julia Roberts and how there's just nothing between them either. And this, I thought, well, maybe this relationship will punch up and will become more interesting than the relationship in Duplicity did, but it really never did.
Right. You can tell he's not interested in her because when she gets knocked off the platform at the end and she's lying dying, he's telling Blackwood all the stuff that Blackwood did, like, so for like 5 minutes. And he doesn't even care if what hurt. Like, her leg could be broken. She's bleeding.
She could be dead. I know.
Yeah. But he's telling the villain everything the villain just did. It's great.
I want to talk about that. Yeah. I want to talk about that scene, by the way, but I want to talk about something else first.
All right. Where do we go?
Well, first I want to talk about something you just alluded to, that introductory scene where he's doing the medical analyzation of the guy he's about to attack.
Right.
I really liked that.
The Matrix part.
Okay.
Yeah. I really liked that because of what you said about this being not being an origin story, because one of the things that caught me about this right away, Tom, was how it was – this is an origin movie without being an origin story, without having all the hoo-ha of how he became Iron Man or how he became Sherlock, the capital letter Sherlock Holmes. And that opening scene I thought was such a great idea of how do we show his powers of deduction in an active way and show he's a man of action. And so you got this whole breakdown of him deducing things about the guy. Well, this is where I hit him and this is what I'm going to do. And then he executes all these moves. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was great.
Okay.
And then you go and you duplicate that in this meaningless boxing scene that goes on way too long. It goes on so long, I think Far and Away is about to break into the movie. And it just goes on and on. And it falls into this trap of, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do, and then I'm going to do exactly what I just told you what I'm going to do, and nothing's going to go wrong. It's and that's almost death in a movie. And not only that, the boxing scene tells us nothing about his powers of deduction. It just tells us where he's going to hit the guy, as if you said earlier, he's got this preternatural medical sense. And if you want to use this deduction cam, then use it in other ways later on. Don't use it in this useless boxing scene.
Especially when we've already seen it. That scene could have been lost. Yeah.
Exactly.
And that's why when I first saw it, I was like, okay, you're going to do that? All right, let's see what you're going to do with it. And they do nothing with that. You know, the mysteries that were solved and the obstacles he faced in this movie were so just half-baked.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that the huge reveal at the end was a technobabble about some plant he took to stop his pulse. I mean, that's that's what they're saving for last, is the dried rhododendron.
Oh, it's oil.
Okay, what time is it?
Oh, I just couldn't believe that's what they came up with. And the other one, using his that he collaborates with Rachel McAdams to use his pipe as a MacGyver improv bomb to knock loose the poison gas canister.
Oh, yeah. And what about where she shoots the gun at the guy and then it goes click, 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 and then she uses the powder from the shells to jumpstart the machine or something, or make a little explosion?
Yeah, she MacGyvered a bomb.
But her bullets shouldn't have had any powder in them.
Maybe they were other bullets. Maybe they were her reloads. I don't know. But yeah, there was just
stuff. I don't speak French.
Stuff like that.
I think she'd walked over one of the bodies and automatically picked up a new.
Nice.
So did she leave town at the end? Is she wounded from that fall? Why is she working for Moriarty? And Holmes steals the jewel that she stole by sleeping with the Maharaja and then pawns it to give to Watson as an engagement ring. What?
I think the implication is that he actually makes the engagement ring out of that jewel. It's not pawned, is it?
He makes the jewel.
No, he takes the jewel and makes it into an engagement ring. I thought her engagement ring in the end was the jewel
The original one's red.
From Riley or whatever.
She's wearing like a silver one. And it's not red.
Well, it's got a red outline, I think. I mean, I don't want to discuss men's fashion with you and women's jewelry, but that's what
that ship sailed.
Did you guys recognize Kelly Riley? Or no, not Kelly Riley. Kathy
Mary Riley.
Mary Riley.
Mary Riley. Did you recognize her from anything?
It wasn't really Mary Riley.
Oh,
I think you're right. It was Kelly Riley.
Yeah. So you guys didn't. So you guys haven't seen a movie called Eden Lake, have you?
No.
Oh, Eden Lake. Yeah.
Have you really?
No.
Oh.
Good what Lord. Is it?
Eden Lake is this great English horror movie that's a variation on Little Red Riding Hood. And the lead character is the actress who played Mary. And she's wonderful in Eden Lake. So I was really glad to see her in this.
Is she British?
She's very British, yep.
Very British.
And she's she's the Little Red Riding Hood character.
What did you think of her in this?
Well, I was busy trying to place her. I knew I'd seen her in something. So I was fascinated by her, and because I was so bored with the rest of the movie, I spent a lot of time wondering who that was and watching her closely. So I quite liked her in this. Why do you ask?
No, I liked her too, but the people I was with were annoyed by her. The women I saw the movie with were annoyed by her. They thought she was too mean and dislikable, and I was trying to tell them we're supposed to have doubts about her.
The audience that I saw it with gasped when she threw her drink onto Sherlock Holmes.
Really?
I couldn't believe the audience was that invested in the movie that early.
Huh.
It got an ooh, like out loud from the audience.
I think people really like Robert Downey Jr., and that's what they're oohing about.
Yeah. So were you guys with me, though, that you thought – so Dingus, you said he looked bored. Or Kelly, you said he looked bored. Like, you guys agree that he was just – so unpresent in this. You're with me?
Oh yeah. I think Kelly might have alluded to this earlier, and I'm a sucker for a good line too, and he did a lot of cute line deliveries.
I can't lay bricks without clay. That's kinda good. That works.
Yeah, he had a lot of little moments.
There's some good writing buried in there beneath all the chaff, actually. There's some good writing, and I feel bad for the good writers. Well, they don't care. They just made a fortune.
That's right.
Right. So,
let me ask you guys about certain parts of the script that I'm curious whether they worked for you. So we've talked a little bit about the flash forward stuff. I was a little disappointed that more wasn't done of that. I was fascinated with what I feel they were trying to do with Watson, having a gambling addiction, being a hero of the Afghan War, trying to leave Holmes and lead a normal life. But again, I didn't feel that much was done with that because it was so one note throughout.
And it's never really resolved, that I could tell.
And I think the idea is that there's supposed to be some tension about will he leave or won't he? And that's stupid.
It goes unanswered.
But we know there's no tension there, just like there's no tension about Rachel McAdams getting drawn into the pig-cutting bandsaw. You know that's not going to happen. And
After she's been set up as a badass. They did that 28 Days Later, too, where they have this awesome female protagonist, and then she gets soft towards the end. I hate that.
But that's allowed in 28 Days Later. It's not allowed in a comic book movie like this. Go ahead.
This is classic British literature.
No.
These are Penny Dreadfuls. Totally different concept.
Oh, surely this was a graphic novel. Are you kidding?
What were you going to say? I'm sorry.
I was just going to say I quite liked what Jude Law was doing. I liked their chemistry, and I particularly liked – and I don't have – much of a present knowledge of Sherlock Holmes. I don't remember a lot. I read the stories when I was quite young. But it seems I remember Watson being more of a toady you're brilliant, Holmes. You're constantly brilliant. And maybe this is from some cartoon I saw. But I liked the sense of their relationship that he had more going on, that he was trying to break away. And for me, it felt a little bit more like the relationship between Aubrey and I'm not sure how you say his name, the Aubrey Matron relationship in the Patrick O'Brien books that Master and Commander was made from. So that you've got the doctor and the captain, or you have the doctor and Sherlock Holmes, and there's a tension between them. And Holmes is a little bit condescending to him. Oh, you're getting better. And Watson is sort of rolling his eyes, like he has to constantly get Holmes out of the messes he gets himself into, and I felt that they were a little more equal than I remember the relationship being from the story. But again, I could be totally off.
Well, it seemed to me one of the problems is they weren't that different from each other.
Yeah,
they were both very complete, very competent. Right. They didn't need each other. I mean, the movie could have been about either one of them, and it wouldn't have been any the worse off.
Yeah, and they were both brawny and smart.
Right.
So.
I think we're supposed to get the feeling that Holmes definitely needs him.
Well, we're supposed to get the feeling
that
Simon
and Simon need each other.
I can't go. I don't even know what.
Tom was on that. One, two, three.
Like Murtaugh and Riggs need each other.
I see they were trying to do that, but I just didn't get that sense. I mean, they both were so competent and these sort of complete package heroes. that it didn't feel like either of them was taking up the slack for the other. They didn't just seem to complement each other in any way. I don't know.
You know, and I think that you're making a good point, Tom. And this is what upset me about the early thing where he deduces where to hit the guy is it seems like Sherlock Holmes has all this medical knowledge, and that should be Watson's purview.
Right.
Yeah, he never does any doctoring. Yeah, I don't think in the stories he did much either, though. Yeah. He's Dr. Watson, but he never operates on Holmes. He never cleans.
Well, and they give him both these tokens.
He's his dealer.
Yeah, they give him both these token flaws. It didn't go anywhere, you know, so Watson is into gambling and Holmes is into drinking.
Yeah, I never gamble.
Yeah, right. And they both overcome their flaws just fine. Neither of them really helps. I guess, what is it, like Holmes keeps Watson's promissory notes or whatever those things were? Like he doesn't give him his money, maybe?
Right. Well, this is very late in their relationship. You know, this is when they're about to break up, yeah. Which is something I liked about the movie. I liked that this is where we're finding them. And I didn't mind the idea that, okay, now we're going to launch into a franchise. I just hope that somebody else does it. And Tom, you seem very forgiving of Guy Ritchie. I'm not so forgiving of him.
Well, okay, here's why I'm forgiving of Guy Ritchie. He doesn't do action movies, and this is what was expected of him in this movie. Sherlock Holmes is an action movie. I mean, this thing is clearly centered around traditional set pieces with explosions and a big giant fighting guy who speaks French for some reason I didn't ever understand, and a villain, and a diabolical plot, and gimmicks. And that's not Guy Ritchie's thing. Guy Ritchie's thing is the interplay of lots of crazy characters in contemporary London, and he does it wonderfully. And mm-hmm. I just feel like he was out of his element here. This isn't the sort of thing he should be doing. I know he's a good director, and the sooner he gets off of this and makes the next rock and roll a movie, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Amen.
And so here, and another thing, you know, he brought Mark Strong over to be the villain in this thing. Mark Strong is phenomenal in Rock and Rolla. He's the anchor for that movie. I mean, Guy Ritchie knows how to swirl chaos around this just rock hard core. You know, Mark Strong is the heart of that movie. And everything in Rock and Rolla swirls around him, and it's a beautiful arrangement. And he gets wasted as the villain in Sherlock Holmes. I mean, he was such a non-entity. He just looked menacing and delivered these vaguely threatening declarations and then was foiled in the ending and kicked off of a bridge. That was so... So Guy Ritchie knows what he's doing. So here's another thing. For a guy who doesn't make action movies, Guy Ritchie knows how to make an action sequence.
Right.
And I think specifically in Rock and Rolla, this is probably where that movie won my heart. There's a scene, it's a simple foot chase. It's a handoff of money gone bad, and it's Gerard Butler being chased by this insanely strong Russian thug. And they're running, they're just chasing each other, running out of breath, and it's an incredible action sequence. And it plays to Guy Ritchie's strengths. I mean, I think a good action sequence needs a few crucial things, and Guy Ritchie knows how to do that. But he wasn't given the tools to do that in Sherlock Holmes. I feel that the script and his actors in Sherlock Holmes let him down. And I can't help but I would love to sort of hear interviews with him and see if I can find some subtext for disappointment. But I can't help but think that he knows that this is not his forte. So I don't know. Maybe I'm being a Guy Ritchie apologist. But I just don't want to blame him for why Sherlock Holmes was so unengaging.
Who would you, in both of you can answer this, who would you rather have had direct this? Or does it even matter given the other elements are failings?
David Lean.
Well, that's a good question, Dingus, because it's I don't know. I mean, I really think it's just a bad script and the casting, the central, you know, the lead character just isn't up to the task. Robert Downey Jr. is too contemporary for this rich, evocative picture of London that they're trying to paint. I don't know.
Rachel McAdams might be too. She looks
yeah, absolutely.
She looks very modern to me.
Absolutely. Yep. Yep. Do you have an answer for that, Dingus?
Yes, I would say Christopher Nolan.
Well, but now you're just naming excellent directors.
No, I'm not. I was thinking of him specifically because I was thinking of the way Dark Knight was directed, and then just for period reasons, the way Prestige developed itself as a movie.
Oh, damn. Yeah, you know what?
And also, Hans Zimmer's score annoyed the hell out of me. And it just was – that's one of the reasons why I felt just beat up and brutalized at the end of this, because this score was like a sledgehammer. And then I think, am I just sick of him the way I'm sick of the guy who did Avatar? I can't even remember James, whatever his name is. And I went back and looked, and he did the score for Dark Knight, and I remember loving that music. And then I remember the way and the touches Christopher Nolan did, both with Batman Begins and Dark Knight, and of course with The Prestige, and how this film needed those breathing spaces and needed somebody who has an understanding of how to let action shape the characters and shape the film rather than letting it define the film.
Man, that's a great answer. I wish I'd thought of that. Can I change my answer?
You can, but I wasn't just naming random guys who can direct.
I really felt
Christopher Nolan when I saw this.
You did a great job. I'm going to change my answer to Christopher Nolan.
I'll take Brett Ratner for 50.
but what's interesting to me is you're revealing, and I didn't think of, I feel bad about this, because I was thinking of Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels as more of an action film than it is. And it's not fair to think of Guy Ritchie as an action director. I think you're right about that. And so I was just thinking he's just brutal with his action, but that's not the case. I loved Rock and Rolla.
Yeah.
That doesn't give someone a free pass, though.
It doesn't give him a free pass, but the thing is, I just know what Guy Ritchie can do when he's given the tools that he had with Rock and Rolla. And I think he wrote his own scripts in that, and Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. And I haven't seen Revolver, so I can't speak to that. Or Swept Away, by the way.
Snatch.
Oh, right, of course, Snatch. Yep, Snatch is an... Duh, how could I have forgotten
that's
that?
Got some good boxing in it.
Snatch.
Well, you know what, Kelly Wands? That's funny, because I wonder, did he just want to put boxing in Sherlock Holmes because of how well that worked in Snatch? I don't know the answer to that.
That's the only stuff he responded to.
Could be.
I think they just gave him the script, and he went, all right, check, please.
Right, exactly.
I think there was a lot less to it. I like your little allegory stuff about the sinking ship being the Imperial Victorian era.
Well, so the reason I came to that, because I did like that sequence, and Dingus, you're absolutely right. There's the weird jump from they're investigating a laboratory, and that's there so that he can find the cattle prod, which is a cool gimmick. I was like, okay, I'll give you... You know, props for that. That was a nifty gimmick to base an action scene around. But then it's sort of they had to get to it. It's like you said, Bing. It's like, okay, now we're going to move over to this soundstage over here.
Yeah.
And there's no okay. So here's bear with me a second. This is going to sound really highfalutin. I am into car chase scenes like there's no tomorrow. I love. Bear with me. I said bear with me. You're not bearing with me. You've already betrayed me, Kelly Wand.
Sorry.
I love car chase scenes, and I've long been very analytical towards them. I can enjoy them viscerally, but I want to know what makes a good car chase scene. And I think there are three things that make a good car chase scene. Character. You have to know who the characters are, and you have to care about them. You know, who's chasing whom here and why.
Vehicles.
Context. You have to know, in the context of the movie, why does it matter who is chasing whom and what are they trying to do and why? What are the stakes of this chase? And then choreography. The simple act of how the cars move and interact. And in thinking about that ship, that fight around the base of the ship, I realized that's not just true of car chase scenes. That's true of any action sequence. It needs those three things, character, context, and choreography. Any action scene needs that. I think of the fight scenes in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Every one of them has excellent choreography. It reveals something about the characters and has context in how the movie unfolds. So I got to thinking about that scene that starts as a fight in the laboratory and then moves to the shipyard. What are the characters? You know, the characters are already established. They don't really do anything with that. The choreography, it's serviceable. But the context I really liked in terms of trying to think about why does a movie set in 19th century Britain, you know, what are you going to do with a fight at the base of this shipyard? And I immediately know, I liked, too, the choreography in a way where it comes to the shipyard, and they're swinging a hammer, and you immediately know once they start hitting those struts, and probably even before they hit the struts, what's going to happen. You know, they are setting up a good bit of choreography. You know, here's this huge ship, and we're going to slowly knock it over, and somebody's going to get smashed or whatever. I like that setup quite a bit. The moment you see the guy with the hammer and the struts are gradually being knocked out, that was a good bit of choreography. And there was these should have been good characters. You know, you should have a good Holmes and Watson. And the context, this stuff about a shipyard in 19th century London, and you can set the context in terms of what the villain is trying to do to reconquer America. There was just so much possibility there that I was excited at that point, and none of that was followed up on, I thought. But there was a lot of promise that I felt just sort of failed. So that's what I thought of with that action sequence. Dingus, you didn't like it, but I quite liked what that could have been, if not what it was.
That's interesting. When you first mentioned the car chase thing, I thought you were going to go in a different direction, because you've often talked about it, or I remember after I really liked Wanted, and you just were completely uninterested in the car stunts in that, because they were clearly digital and it just didn't seem real to you in any way, and so it seemed like there was no stakes in any of that digital crap. And for me, that's how that scene felt. When he started swinging that hammer or that mallet or that axe or whatever that huge thing is, the sledgehammer, mm-hmm. and he's knocking out the struts, I just got a sinking feeling, no pun intended, that, oh, is that what they're going to do? He's just going to keep hitting these things over and over again? Is that what's going to happen? And none of it felt real.
Well, but what they should have done, Dingus, is, you know, they set up what's going to happen, and then it should have been exciting waiting for it to happen and seeing
or
how
it twists somehow. Like it's not going to be.
Right. Go ahead.
That's okay. In your description, what you're describing, those elements, what just leapt to mind for me was the fight scene on the flying wing in Raiders of the Lost Ark. All the choreography all around I don't know what the name of the plane is. I just call it a flying wing. I think that's one of the terms for it. When Indiana Jones is fighting that big guy and they're just all around this plane and the propellers are going and it culminates in these huge explosions and all of that builds beautifully. And I thought it was real and it was exciting, even though I know it's a goofy Indiana Jones film.
Well, that, again, that plays on the promise. You know, the character is there, the context in terms of trying to – is that before – is that, like, right before he intercepts, like, before the Ark gets put on the convoy?
Because the Ark is about to be loaded on a plane.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the context. And then the choreography with the chocks being pulled out from under the wheel and the propeller. I mean, that's Steven Spielberg at his shrewdest. He knows how to do an action set piece like that. Like, The T-Rex attack is one of the most brilliant action sequences in history, I think. That Indiana Jones thing right there, Dingus, is perfect. And here's another thing with that ship scene where it ends up betraying its promise. So Sherlock Holmes falls into a groove, like he gets knocked out. And I remember thinking, oh, yeah, okay, that's the groove that the ship is going to slide down and he's going to get smushed. You know, he's got to get out of that groove. You know, that's okay. Now we see the stakes. Watson's got to move him out of there.
Yeah.
And then the ship goes over, and I was like, oh, no, they just put him in a groove for no reason.
Yeah.
But then, oh, the chain's coming loose. Oh, that groove is where the chain is going to come down. And then, oh, no, he just ducks under it.
He ducked under it. Watson covers it with his body. So now they have two things in the groove.
Sure, that's another stupid thing. Sherlock Holmes could have just ducked.
Way less time than Watson moving his body into the way. Now they have two things in the way.
I mean, it's just the choreography was so poorly established, and I think that's...
What did that mean character-wise? Like, oh, Watson risked his life. He tried to save Holmes. Like, well, yeah.
And he didn't even need to. He could have just yelled, Holmes, duck.
Gee, I guess they like each other after all.
But thing is, that's something, like you're talking about the car chases in Wanted. Because they can be digital, it just gives them, in a way, they just go for spectacle. Let's have a giant chain and a giant, what do you call the round thing that a chain wraps on? Whatever that thing... Yeah, when it gets, like, yanked free, and they just throw that stuff in there because they can do it pain-free with the CG, and it doesn't have to mean anything, and it doesn't matter because it looks big and cool.
That's why Hal Needham was our greatest American director.
From Bonnie and Clyde.
Uh, I meant Smoking the Bandit, but okay.
There you go.
Well, I have a couple other things I want to say.
All right, rock and roll.
I have two minor gripes, and then something that I alluded to earlier about the final scenes. My minor gripes are, I started to get a sinking feeling in the boxing scene. I really started to think, when we had a dog fart joke.
Oh God, that's right.
And I went, oh really? Is that what's happening now? Because I was trying to like the film, and I was just feeling empty. And this always bothers me, and I'm probably the only person on this podcast that bothers. But Robert Downey Jr., when they get into the, I think it's the pig slaughterhouse, and he looks at the Bible verses, he says Revelations, and that always drives me nuts.
Because it's the Revelation of St. John.
It's the Book of Revelation. And why can't anybody get that? It drives me crazy. So he's supposed to be such a smart guy, and he doesn't know.
It's like he might as well have said nuclear.
Yeah, exactly. So finally, I want to talk about that scene. Is it London Bridge that they're on at the end?
So they're
up in the.
And that's another thing where they're clearly, you know, this is the. You know, London, the Industrial Revolution,
yeah.
All this
construction.
So yeah, that was London Bridge, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't it?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
But one thing that really struck me while I was watching that scene up on that high planks where he's hanging, where Blackwood is hanging on, and she's just fallen over, was how little impact any of the height had on me. And here, you guys are going to hate this. I was wondering if height in movies, or at least for this movie, had been spoiled by the 3D experience of watching Avatar.
No, it's just shot wrong.
It was just shot wrong? Okay.
I think Kelly Wand is right.
Because it felt totally flat to me. It didn't have any sense that there was any real depth of field, even though it, you know, and part of it might have been the way the city looked kind of like a cartoon in the background in ways. Certain shots of it. But I was wondering if the 3D elements, because there was 3D elements in Avatar when they were up on the branches and showing what the drop was like that I really liked. And I was wondering, as I watched this, has that ruined height for me in other films? But Kelly, you think it's just because it was shot wrong?
Yeah, shot wrong. That's the technical term.
Okay.
And I go with Kelly. And by the way, it wasn't London Bridge. It was Tower Bridge.
Did you just look that up?
No, I just drew that from my not unconsiderable powers of deduction. And, yeah.
Well, it seems that somebody says something about towers when they're going by. Look at those towers.
It was built in 1894. And it was...
You can tell that by the cufflinks that Dingus is wearing right now. Shoes.
I did quickly Google it because I just wanted to make sure. It's not London Bridge, is something else, and it looks very boring. This was the Tower Bridge, and it was close to the Tower of London, which is, I think, where political prisoners were locked up. And it's this iconic structure from the London skyline.
It's like Google's our era's Sherlock Holmes, huh?
Exactly. You don't need any Sherlock Holmes. You just need, like, an iPhone with your 3G connection.
Or a droid.
So let's talk a bit about the diabolical plot. Mm-hmm. So I hated most of the reveals about, oh, look, he just had a harness, so he didn't really hang. Oh, he ate a magical rhododendron that made him seem dead. Like, all of that stuff, I could see that coming. Yeah. You didn't have
Why
to
didn't they just cremate him? That would have solved the problem.
Exactly. There you go. But I ultimately liked the idea that they were going for, that this guy wanted to control the House of Lords, you know, wanted to control the British Parliament so that they could reconquer America. I liked that unfolded. But they did
that by making a machine that pumps gas into the room.
Well, so here's the thing, and I presume Kelly Wand, you might know this, is this a normal tenet of Sherlock Holmes stories where everybody, like Hound of the Baskervilles, everybody thinks it's this demon hound on the moors, but it's not. It's everybody thinks it's something supernatural, but Sherlock Holmes comes in and with logic shows that it's strictly scientific. There's a logical explanation, like Scooby-Doo.
Right.
Is that how most – is that the normal arc for Sherlock Holmes? Is it he dispels
No, usually it's just someone shows up at his apartment and goes, hey, I need you to find some cufflinks I lost and a powder brush. And then he figures it out, wanders around a little bit.
Oh, so there's none of this like foreboding stuff about the Book of Revelations and a guy being raised from the dead and oh, okay.
There wasn't anything about
magic going on at that time and the supernatural?
I think Count of the Baskervilles was an exception, and then that's why that one sticks out. But most of them are just short stories where it's just him and...
And he's just solving some sort of mundane crime or situation, like Encyclopedia Brown kind of thing.
Yeah. Right.
This made me think more of Brotherhood of the Wolf than Encyclopedia
Brown. Right. Well, but I like that concept, though, that, you know, everybody's like, we're going to show this supernatural thing, and that seems to me, I mean, that's another, I mean, it's, I guess, the Scooby-Doo thing is what I think of, where you go to the easy supernatural explanation, and you think, oh, it's going to be cool, there's going to be something evil, but it's not, it's all scientific. So I liked the bit about the fact that he was going to pump this poisonous gas into Parliament, and he was going to dupe all of his fellow members of this order because he made them drink the antidote without telling them what it was. So I liked that reveal. That was the only, like, mystery-solving bit that I enjoyed. The rest of it I thought was pretty anticlimactic.
Yeah, I was surprised by I didn't see they had taken the antidote thing coming. I knew that all the supernatural stuff was going to wind up having an explanation, but I didn't see that coming. That was kind of cool. But what I didn't understand is why he, after saying when Holmes was in the pig slaughterhouse, you're going to see tomorrow all of these things, and then he tries to blow them up. I didn't understand that, and I didn't see that.
Good point. Oops. And I also hate it too when. So the bad guy is obviously speaking to him over some sort of a speaking tube, so his voice sounds everywhere. And then he sticks his face right in the wall beside two guys with guns who just turn around and shoot him in the face. I mean, what was that? That was so stupid.
I don't remember that.
It's when, there's mysterious voices, and I think Holmes even says, you know, don't waste your bullets, Watson. And then Mark Strong thrusts his face into a crack in the wall behind them. You know, it's a movie scare. And says, bah, or something like that.
Here's Johnny.
Yeah, exactly. And they turn around and just fire wildly into the wall. You know, what kind of idiot...
No one got shot in this whole movie. And there's tons of gunplay.
And, like, seriously amped up, like, Foley sound effect gunplay, too.
Yeah.
These were, like, heavy caliber weapons. This was like an M249. Like, this was serious stuff. They had serious firepower here.
Stories where he shoots people, though, and there's like
Sherlock Holmes does
guns. Yeah,
wow. Oh, that's awesome. Okay,
there's more action than you would think.
Good.
But it's more colorful and Rudyard Kiplingy kind of.
All right. Now, are you guys like me in that when you're watching one of these movies, and I think this is a common thing in the audience, that you secretly hope the bad guy's diabolical plot will actually work, even though you know it won't? Like, are you kind of rooting for Parliament to be gassed?
Usually.
Is that just me? I mean, I was. You know what? These imperialist British colonialists, yeah, gas them all. I was like, go for it. Go Mark Strong. Do it.
Okay. Maybe it's for a greater good, and he'll be the best ruler, and he's just using these dubious means to accomplish greater ends.
You know, that
why don't they just put Holmes in charge if he's so smart? Why doesn't Holmes run?
We'll just put Holmes in charge. That question, Tom, actually gives me a chilling memory from my childhood.
Uh-oh.
I don't know if I want to share this or save it for 3x3.
No, you've laid a card on the table. You got to turn it over now.
Yeah, play the Parliament card. Childhood.
Did either of you ever see a movie called Black Sunday?
Yeah, because you want that's the sort of thing. You want the blimp. To crash into the Super Bowl or the World Series or whatever that is. Yeah, of course. That's a natural reaction, I think.
Well, I saw that with my father, and I don't know when that came out, but I had to be pretty young. Somebody quick, clickety-click. And after the movie, you know, I remember like going home, Dad and I driving home, and me saying, and I don't even remember how I put it, but it was something like, did you ever kind of feel like what would happen if they had actually succeeded and the blimp had exploded into the Super Bowl? And and my dad, I remember his reaction was so aghast that I would even come up with that. No, of course not. I think it was just, he was just so, not violent, but just immediate.
Yeah.
And I just immediately shut up.
Well, as kids, we think of that as spectacle.
Think of it as possibilities for the movie, was the grown-ups are going, well, we know that's not going to happen, so they don't worry about it. But when we watch Avatar, when kids watch Avatar, they go, oh, he could fall from the dragon. This could happen any second.
Well, I mean, some movies will do that. I mean, I admire a movie that, like, for instance, don't they nuke the Denver, a football game in Denver in some Tom Clancy movie?
In some of All Fears. Baltimore. Yeah, I think you're right.
There you go. They nuke Denver, if I'm not mistaken. And isn't there a Keanu Reeves movie where he outruns a nuclear blast on a motorcycle?
Yeah.
I think he's in a refrigerator.
It's one where he invents water or something.
Yeah, it's one of those. So some movies do that. Did you guys see Eagle Eye by any chance? I know this already.
No.
So the plot in Eagle Eye is to blow up Congress. Mm. And I can't imagine anybody not, because Congress has a notoriously low approval rating because it's a political, nobody supports Congress. So that was the most stupid plot for a movie, because everybody in the audience is like, yeah, sure, blow up Congress, absolutely. You know, I hope the bad guy wins. So what they had to do in Eagle Eye to counter that natural reaction from people watching this movie is it's when a school band is performing for Congress. You know, they have to put children in the session of Congress to prevent that natural reaction for you think, yeah, go ahead, blow up Congress. Like, oh, no, there's kids here now. So you see how this is. So, sorry, that's a spoiler for Eagle Eye in case.
Well, and in Die Hard 4, remember, the bad guy makes everyone think he blew up the White House for a few seconds, and then one of the cops runs outside, and he goes, oh, my God, no. Oh, it's fine. So you're supposed to worry about the structure.
Actually, you know what, though, Kelly Wand? That is part of what I liked in Die Hard 4, how much of Timothy Oliphant's plans actually came to fruition. You know, how much damage he was able to do to the infrastructure. So cheers to Die Hard 4 for that.
Yeah, he did blow up that freeway, too.
Yeah, well, he shut down entire cities.
That's more than the nanobots in Day the Earth Stood Still could do. They could just eat one truck.
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between, counting 1, 2, 3, feet apart, never free, getting down with 3 feet, everybody loves me.
I came in way late on that one.
Yeah, ruined
the button. And by the way, the nanobots did a lot more damage than that in Day of the Earth.
Yeah, they had a stadium, too. That's true.
They got their fill. Okay, this week's three.
And I wanted to mention No Shit, Sherlock, but I didn't get there.
Yeah, I was going to do that too.
Oh, well.
Someone say that?
I was about to.
Okay. Sorry, we missed that. Should we
record at the end that, well, why don't they just say No Shit, Sherlock? Why not?
Too contemporary. So this week's 3x3 is mine. And what I've asked you guys to come up with this week, three movies that make a political point and that don't hit you over the head with it. This was in response to Avatar from last week, which I felt made a political point and hit you over the head with it. I didn't even think it was that good a political point.
So, oh, it's oil.
Exactly.
Thanks, James Cameron.
So
it's political because it's a mineral slime.
Kelly, what do you got for us for your number three?
My number three political movie thing type deal is 1933's Duck Soup. I know you guys don't see any movies made before 2008. I doubt you know who the Marx Brothers are, but
there ain't no sanity clause.
That's not from the movie, but okay. It was kind of Doctor Strangelove before Doctor.
All right, so you just missed it. We just spoke for an awesome half hour about our three picks each before I realized we weren't recording. So we're going to take it from where Kelly Wand introduced his third. By the way, so this is our 10th, our 11th episode?
I've already 11.
11. Okay, I've been deathly afraid this is going to happen, so I count ourselves lucky that it hasn't happened up till now and that we only lost 20, 30 minutes. So Kelly Wand, you had just mentioned this Marx Brothers comedy called Duck Soup as your number three pick for a movie that made a good political point.
Yes, my number three choice was Duck Soup.
And why would you pick a Marx Brothers comedy?
Oh, well, this is tarring with a pretty broad brush, but I feel that all war movies made after we drop the bomb have a defensive quality.
Are you reading this? Did you write this down?
No, I just remember this one part.
Because you're doing pretty good verbatim. Well done. Carry on, though. I'm sorry.
Because in modern times, the prevailing theme of the movies is that war is bad because we'll all blow up. As opposed to the quaint notions of Duck Soup, which were that nationalism itself is bad, and at the end, Duck Soup compares nationalism to a minstrel show. So how much more political can you get than that?
Now, so we've already talked a little bit about this, so we can actually play on what we said. Is Duck Soup, is that message dated? Like, is there anything relevant about Duck Soup, or do you sort of think of it as a quaint reminder of an earlier time?
It's not, well, it's, the message maybe is dated by that standard, but war is more like Duck Soup now than it was before because there's less threat of nuclear war. Mm-hmm. And it's more, except now we're the Sylvanians of Duck Soup.
So you explained to us before, because Dingus and I have not seen Duck Soup, that
really?
That's the one where...
I've seen it. It's just been many, many years. And that's, at the beginning of this, I made a Night at the Opera reference, but I have seen Duck Soup.
Margaret Dumont hires Groucho Marx to rule over this country called Fredonia, and then espionage hijinks ensue.
Okay. And the political...
So that's its political point, and that's totally not quaint.
Is that right? Don't put Groucho Marx in charge of your country.
Right. And he says...
So you're saying... But you're saying that applies to the election of George Bush Jr., of George Herbert Walker Bush to the presidency. I think that's the relevance there.
And Obama.
Hey, whoa.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
We're Obama apologists on this podcast. Didn't you... That's a prerequisite.
Well, you're the one who says Reagan won the Cold War.
No, I don't. I did not.
Spoiler. Again, another spoiler.
Yeah. You don't have any evidence. That's not documented because the reporter was not playing, just so you know. But we will get there. All right. So Duck Soup is a good one. I like, by the way, that two of – another spoiler. I like the fact that two of your picks are really old movies. So stick around and see what Kelly wants other really old movies. So my number three is a movie called Catch.
No.
Dingus, what's your number three? I'm sorry, I couldn't resist because your pick was so good. I really am jealous.
Wait, you loved Cats, the musical?
That memory song, that just says so much to me about the Reagan era, which I miss so much.
I know people call it Monkey Bones instead of Monkey Bone in the Book of St. Monkey Bone.
That's awesome.
Spoiler.
So Dingus, your number three. I wanted to steal your number three, but I won't do it. You can have it. So go ahead.
You did a nice job trying to sneak in there.
Yeah, he was doing a good. He was.
Yeah, he fooled for a second there. Before I give my number three, are we recording?
Yes, we are recording. I normally have a counter running, but because I Googled something earlier, I called up a window and was obscuring the counter, but I now see it running. I will now know if we stop recording. As long as I don't Google something, we're safe.
You were Googled.
You're not allowed
on your...
to Google anymore.
Well, it's you guys' fault because you were talking about the London Bridge or the Tower Bridge, so I had to look that up, and it messed up the clock. Anyway, go ahead, Dingus. What's your number three? We are recording. I have an eye on it. We're now in safe hands.
You were Googled on your own petard.
That's good.
All right, my number three is Cash, and I never know how to say it. Cash or cachet?
It's Cash.
Oh, that's the forte. Something.
Very nice. But again, I don't understand why there's an accent over the E if we don't get to say cachet.
Is there an accent over the E?
Yes.
I thought it one of those cursives. Carrots.
It's a grave or a sedile?
I thought it was an agu.
Accent agu. I don't know.
Okay, Cash is my number three. and what I was saying before...
Now, real quick, so say, because I don't think... I'm surprised, Dingus, you and I we know Michael Haneke movies, but explain real quick what Cash is.
How do I explain it? Cash opens with this is how it opens, right? It's this long shot of just the outside of an apartment building, and it goes on and on and on and on and on. And I watched it, and I watched it. And I kept thinking, I kept trying to scrutinize it, looking for clues. What am I supposed to get out of this? And the people whose house is being filmed get a videotape, and it's this videotape is their house being watched. They're being watched in a variety of ways in a variety of places. And this film is about being watched, as far as I'm concerned. It's about some other things, and it makes other political points, which I'm going to let Tom talk about in a second. But for me, as I watched it, the political point for me is how being watched, or I can't even remember what I said. Knowing that you're being watched changes the way you act, changes the way you live your life, and can drive you crazy. And the reason I think of this as the political point I want to get out of this film is because of what has happened to civil liberties, or what I consider as having happened to civil liberties over the last few years in our country, and how it seems that we're becoming increasingly less worried about that. And this film seems to be saying when you are being watched, it changes how you live your life, or when you know that anyway. And then Tom, you made a different point about what the film is saying about France.
Well,
and I like that.
And the a reveal fairly late in the movie. By the way, Dingus, do you remember? And it's kind of a loaded question because there may not be any one answer for this. But do you remember what or whom is watching the house, like the solution to the mystery? And you don't have to say, because it's a big spoiler, but do you remember kind of how it's resolved?
Like, Robert Blake.
if you had to answer who is watching them, do you remember the answer to that, by the way?
I don't think I could.
Okay. And it's kind of cool that you can't, because it's very ambiguous, and it's intentional that way. But the movie also has a lot to say about France's national guilt towards what happened in Algeria. And also this one character's own personal guilt. And it has a lot to do with feelings of guilt. And it applies that on a personal level, but it makes it very clear that it's tying it to France's relation to France's actions in Algeria. Go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say is this echoes something that you talked about last week, and that makes a lot more sense to me now. How ham-handed Avatar, as much as I liked Avatar and loved it, this ham-handed handling of guilt.
Oh, no, very good point. Yeah,
and how much better this film handles guilt. And until you said that, not only about France but about his guilt, the main character's guilt, it didn't really resonate. Until you just said that.
Very good point. So instead of seeing Avatar a third time, you people, I know you're going to do that, just rent Cash, for Pete's sake. It's a better movie about guilt. All right, good.
Don't make them feel guilty about not.
Oh, good. Well done. My number three pick is Paul Greengrass's movie before he was brought into the mainstream, before he did a Bourne Identity movie. He did a documentary-style story about the massacre of 14 people in Londonderry by the British Army. Londonderry is in Ireland, Northern Ireland. And on its surface, you could look at it as a political movie about soldiers firing on protesters. But it's what Paul Greengrass does is, instead of making it about how evil the soldiers are or the occupying British, he makes it a story about how, when things like this unfold, it's just a matter of human weakness, of human frailty. The movie's called Bloody Sunday. I don't think I mentioned that. But Bloody Sunday follows one politician throughout the events of that day that led up to 14 people being shot. And there's this very real sense that he is fighting chaos and fear and insecurity on many different levels from all of the players involved. And he can't stop all of these things from swirling together and resulting in something terrible. And it drives home the fact that politics isn't national decisions and national policy, that it's just people. Bloody Sunday also, we have plenty of movies about war and how terrible war is and that honors the soldiers. But there aren't a lot of movies that honor protesters, who are an important part of the political process when it comes to countries like the United States and Britain, And watching Bloody Sunday, I think, really honors situations like Kent State or Tiananmen Square in China or Burma or Iran, where the situation's very different, where it takes a whole different type of courage to be a protester in those countries than it does in Ireland or when England was occupying India. So I think Bloody Sunday is a great movie, not just about politics, but about the courage it takes to be a protester, to participate in enlightened politics when it starts to fall apart. And I really admire how well it does that. So there you go, my number three pick, Bloody Sunday.
Yeah, good job. Mm-hmm.
Kelly Wand, what is your number? I'm very jealous, Kelly Wand, of your number two pick, by the way.
Yeah, it's my best one, except for Duck Soup and my other one.
It's also the only one I've really seen since. So go ahead. What's your number two pick for a political movie?
My number two pick is Richard Linklater's Fast Food Nation. I believe it's 2007. About the meat industry and the agribusiness industry and how it exploits the poor and how the rich use the weak, in keeping with your theme of people, politics really being about people.
But isn't Fast Food Nation just a boring documentary?
No, actually, it's got characters in it, and it's Altman-esque, in fact, in the way it weaves together different strands of an ensemble cast, both the exploited poor workers, the cows themselves, and even the villains, the whitey corporate types. Because politics, Tom, is just the bureaucratic face of the dismal cycle.
And it's just, you know, Fast Food Nation, so we'd already talked about this, but you quite like the book, Kelly Wand. I had serious problems with the book because I thought it wore an agenda a little bit too much on its sleeve. But I thought the movie did a brilliant job of avoiding that by being about people and being this multi-threaded perspective on this situation, namely the fast food industry.
Right. It puts a human face on the worst aspects of human behavior.
And Richard Linklater knows human faces. I mean, you don't think of him as the go-to guy for a political movie. He's very good with small, quiet moments and interactions between characters. And the way he adapts, is it Eric Schlosser? Schlosserman? I forget the guy's name. But the way he adapts that book, I thought was really subversive and did a much better point of making the Eric Schlosser's point than the book did.
Yeah. Namely, oh, by the way, Bruce Willis is in it for a scene. I don't know if you knew that.
I don't think that's right. Bruce Willis?
Really? I better Google it. Yeah, I'm just opening a new window here. Shouldn't be a problem.
It's got a great cast. And Paul Dano is in it. And the woman from Maria Full of Grace, whose name is Maria Catalina.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, it's a great cast. And a brutal, brutal ending that I don't want to spoil because Dingus has not seen the movie.
Right. Because what I said in take one was that I liked the book a lot, and I didn't. This is the first time I'd heard that the movie was a good movie, and I'm pretty excited about that. So thank you, Kelly Wand.
Mm. You should see it. Everyone who eats food should see Fast Food Nation.
Now, if they're
scared,
if there's one thing, Kelly Wand, I like better than your number two pick, it's Dingus's number two pick. Damn.
This is quite an inversion because the other time you said I had a lot to live up to, and now you know.
Yeah, and you managed it.
Now I have a lot to live up to, and Tom knows I can't.
So what's your number two big pick, Dingus, for a political movie that makes a good political point without hitting you over the head with it?
All right, my number two film is a film from 2007 called 4 Months, 3 Weeks, and 2 Days.
And I thought that was about abortion.
No, actually it's not, as it turns out.
Well, now, come on, be fair, it is.
It's about a calendar. It's not about abortion at all.
All right, you're both fired. I'm going to talk about this movie if you guys can't do it.
It's set in 1980s Romania, and I can't get away from – I'll get to the political point of the movie in just a second, but I get overwhelmed. This happened before. The opening of this movie, it just happens in the middle of a scene. You have to see this movie.
Oh, Dingus. Yeah. Forgot about this. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, the scene with the doctor?
So no. You haven't seen it, right, Kelly Wand?
No.
Oh.
just the way the film opens, it sets the tone. And what I had said before was that there's another foreign film that that I almost chose, and then this one really won over because the way it's shot just sets this time period. And for me, it sets the politics of this time period beautifully. But the scene that really nails the political point that I feel the film is making to me is the scene with the doctor, which I find to be an overwhelming scene even to think about. And what I'd said as well was it's hard for me to imagine watching the film again, even though I'm really quite enamored of it. And the scene with the doctor, what I feel the political point here is that when freedom is denied people, then they are going to be exploited, or this opens them up for exploitation. And that scene with the doctor is I said it before, it knocks me out. It's overwhelming. And then you had made some other point, Tom. I get lost when I talk about this film.
I want to talk too, the opening sequence, and this is where it is truly a treasure. It is a real gift to see a movie like that and know nothing about it. We've already kind of tipped our hand that it's about abortion. I mean, that's part of what's going on. But if you don't know that, when you sit down to watch 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days, it looks like two women getting ready for a date. I mean, it's just two girls in a dorm room or something, and they're getting ready for a date. And the fact that it is indeed about an abortion is a reveal. But of course, anybody—that's the big bullet point for 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days—that it's a movie about abortion, and it's just why I don't like reading about movies. It's why, if a movie is acclaimed or if it's a good director, that's all I need to know. I'll want to see it, and that was just truly a treasure to get to allow that movie to unfold the way the director wanted it to unfold. And that scene with the doctor—it's not as—it's not necessarily graphic or shocking, but what I want to say is that scene with the doctor has almost as much impact as something that's really graphic and shocking, like the rape scene in Irreversible, but in a more insidious way, I think.
Right.
Because it's about what should be a very trusting, important relationship, a doctor and a patient. And, God, that's an amazing movie. That made my list that year, by the way. It was one of my favorites. And the way, where it goes is a beautiful thing as well. It's one of those things where if you're watching it and it's an American movie, you know exactly where it's going to go. But the beauty of someone like the director of this movie is that you don't know what they're going to do. And the decision that's made for where to go with that movie is just lovely. So what I get more out of that movie, and what I think it's about on a larger level, is the evils of communism. And it's as powerful an indictment of communism as any movie I've ever seen. And I value that about it as well, as a staunch conservative when it comes to the way the Cold War unfolded.
Mr. Chick, take down this podcast.
That's good. Very good.
Thanks. I just came up with that.
Because for those of you who missed take one, and
I can do that at will, by the way.
We had a spirited debate about whether or not Reagan ended the Cold War. And just to recap, I won the debate and convinced Kelly Wand and Christian Mistoff,
Marsan,
Moronsky, that Reagan did indeed win the Cold War. So that's what you missed when I screwed up and didn't record.
Boy, is my face red.
I'm really touched that you brought up Irreversible, Tom.
Get it?
Because, no.
Kelly Watt, over the line. Go to your room, Kelly.
Sorry.
We'll finish this without you.
Because, well, Irreversible gets the physical brutality across, 4 months gets across the emotional brutality.
Yes.
And it's really, I didn't even think about that before, but it really is affecting me to think about those two things.
And powerful actresses. The women in that were just so amazing in that movie. And even the doctor, I mean, God, that actor who plays the doctor was just, I got to see that again. That's going right into the queue there.
Is it ever on IFC?
Seems like the kind of thing they'd run. Wasn't it nominated for Best Foreign Picture that year? I can never remember these things. But it definitely got critical recognition.
No, it was. There was some sort of confusion about the release time, so it didn't get nominated for Best Foreign Film. And there was an uproar about it. I'm almost certain about that. Wow. I think there was something messed up in the release date.
Okay. I don't see movies with months in the title because I think it's just too.
The word months is not technically in the title. It's the Romanian word for months.
Yeah. Oh, they don't have months in Romania.
They have a whole different word for stuff over there.
Hmm.
They have loonies.
What's the word for belladonna?
I don't know. I don't
get it. Great.
One, two, three.
All right, is it my turn yet? Are you guys done? Is it my turn for my number two pick? My number two pick is a movie that neither of you has seen, and I know this because we just talked about it in Take One. My number two pick is what I feel is the Doctor Strangelove for this generation. If you look at how movies, and before that books, dealt with the political nightmare scenarios, I think of the fear of fascism that George Orwell wrote about in 1984. I think of the madness of the Cold War that Stanley Kubrick captured in Doctor Strangelove. And today, post-Cold War, post-invasion of Iraq, the movie that addresses to me the nightmare scenario of the current political shape of the world is called In the Loop. And it's a director named Arnaldo Iannucciano. I'm sure I screwed that up. But he did a sitcom in Britain about parliamentary politics. And he went from that, using some of the same cast, they play different characters for the most part, to make a similarly funny movie shot in the Office documentary style about the interplay between Britain and the United States leading up to the invasion of Iraq. And In the Loop, part of the beauty of it, it never even mentions the word Iraq. It's so it's not pulling the easiest political strings. In a way, it's timeless. But in a way, it's not, because it's clearly about the current situation. But the beauty of it is that whereas Orwell talked about fascism and Kubrick talked about the Cold War and nuclear weapons, In the Loop talks about bureaucracy and incompetence. And that, I feel, is what drove the invasion of Iraq. It's very facile to come up with easy explanations, like we did it for oil or we did it for freedom. Neither of those is the case. The reason we invaded Iraq is completely different. Most people don't have a clue, and I don't mean that to insult them. It's just it was never made clear. The reason we invaded Iraq, I feel, was ultimately we meant well, but there was just so much incompetence and so much bureaucracy about it that it was bungled. And In the Loop is, I think, a beautiful examination of what that does to how that happens and what that does to the people who are involved. So you guys need to see In the Loop.
Oh, it's unobtainium.
Thank you, James Cameron.
All right, so that's my number two. I think we are now down to everybody's number one. Kelly Wand, your number one is...
Political movie that doesn't hammer you over the head. Is Paths of Glory by Stanley Kubrick, because it's about World War I, which is good. And also, in addition to that... It goes into the concept of being right in a moral debate not mattering if you're in the minority, which is both instructive and the key to understanding politics for the human species.
And it's like a Kirk Douglas movie, right?
Yeah, Kirk Douglas is in it. He plays a French major, colonel, something or other. He's defending... some French soldiers who refused to fire on friendly troops at the egomaniacal behest of a superior. And it's basically a courtroom movie, but it's not.
Have you seen it recently?
No.
So you're not, do you know if it holds up?
I know the last scene of the French girl singing is kind of boring and an anticlimax, and you should fast forward through it, and it makes her voice high-pitched.
So instead of seeing the Chipmunks movie, you can just do that. All right.
I just remember the cover of the DVD, or the might even be the VHS tape when I looked at it at the library. I can't remember when I saw it. It just looks like he's yelling in the middle of battle.
Who? Kirk Douglas?
Yeah.
Oh, that's misleading.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think he's even actually in the battle.
No, but it's made to look like an action moment.
Like he's going to lead the charge. Awesome.
Well, it's definitely a title that suggests that. It's definitely a
What's the title from? Actually, what is the source material for it?
Dingus knows.
It's Clash of the Titans. It's a remake of Clash of the Titans.
That's not true. I always assume that courtroom dramas are adapted from plays. I don't know if that's the case here, but I was just going to float that. I don't know.
It's based on a novel by Humphrey Cobb.
Aha! That was going to be my second choice.
And it's from the title's from a Thomas Gray poem called Elegy Written in a Country Churchyard.
Well done.
Well, oh, nice.
It's all coming back to me. Whoops.
Kelly Wand, I forgot that this was World War One, and for this makes me think of a movie that quite surprised me. Did you ever see All Quiet on the Western Front?
Yeah, the original one?
Yeah.
It's one of the only two movies I can think of where it's told from the Germans' point of view, with the other being Das Boot.
I can't imagine that is All Quiet on the... I mean, that book is so magical. I can't imagine that movie holds up. Like, is the All Quiet on the Western Front movie good?
I hate to say this, but I didn't read the book, and I saw the movie only maybe, I don't know, 10 years ago, and I remember being really moved by it.
Okay.
Yeah, the last shot's really good.
All right. I just didn't expect it to be... I don't know what I was expecting, but so anti-war.
All Quiet on the Western Front.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Especially
something written that soon after the actual conflict.
Right. I wonder, too, if that's the sort of thing that it really takes the perspective of the defeated party to bring to the table. The fact that it's from the German, it's a German book from the German perspective. Actually, right. I'm assuming Erich Maria Remarque, isn't that his name? I presume he was German, yeah.
I don't know.
Okay. Did you guys read the book Johnny Got His Gun by Dalton Trumbo, who wrote the screenplay of Spartacus?
Did not. What is that?
It's a book told from the point of view of a World War I veteran who's quadriplegic as a result of a war injury and blind and deaf and mute. So he's like, he can't tell when he's asleep or not. And it's all told from his point of view, first person. It's like him trying to piece together where he is and what's going on and how to communicate.
Wow, geez, way to bring me down, Kelly Wand.
It's harsh. It's a harsh read.
I think I'd rather just watch Born on the 4th of July again. I'll just do that. Is that okay?
I'm not signing up for that.
By the way, did I scoop your number one pick, Dingus?
Nicely done. Because he never hits you over the head with political points, that Oliver Stone.
Come on, W. It's either W or Born on the 4th of July. That's your number one pick, right?
No, it's JFK.
That's a lie. What is your number? So actually, we are now caught up with our take one that I fumbled and didn't record. So now this is all new, by the way, right?
Right.
So if we suck from here on out, it's because we actually suck.
Right, exactly. Because what's your number one pick for a political movie that makes a good political point without hitting you over the head?
All right, number one for me is another 2007 film. And I was going to play the guessing quote game with you guys, but I got so I got so into the discussion we were having that I just went ahead and said the title, so you already know it. It's The Visitor.
Oh, right. God, I forgot you even said that. Oh, yeah. Oh, God, now I want to change mine.
Now we're caught up.
Yeah, here we are. This film makes a number of political points that might be quite obvious, but what I want to say is, and we didn't necessarily talk about this, but we talked about it in take one, how difficult it was for us to come up with our choices this time around. And early this week, as I was fumbling around trying to think of political movies, I was thinking of trying to game the category by making it the politics of romance, the politics of relationships, the politics of sports.
We would not have let that fly. We would have slapped that down in a second. Me and Kelly Wand would have, yeah.
Do you mean Kelly Zapped Wand? Is that who you're talking about?
The politics of podcasting.
Right. But it turned out I didn't need to do any of that because this category actually was quite rich. And the more I thought about it, the more possibilities. But The Visitor is very exciting to me because of something, a couple things Tom has been saying about character. I think both of you have been saying about character and also about bureaucracy that I think you said about In the Loop. And the key for me, as far as the political point of this film is at the end when Walter says the line, "We are not helpless children." And I think that, that the political point, as far as I'm concerned, again, the film makes a number of points, but this way that bureaucracy and just the mindless, faceless bureaucracy, even when it has an actual face who can't do anything because of the laws of the bureaucracy, makes the people on the other side of the glass into children and ruins beauty. So there you go.
Damn, that's good.
Yeah. I did it the first time.
And the ending in The Visitor is so, like, that movie has so much, and I want to, there's a lot of anger in that movie, but it's not worn as anger. I mean, the conclusion of that movie, the final shot, the final image of Walter, of his anger being swallowed up by, is just amazing to me.
Yeah.
Damn, I want to change my pick. Dingus.
I also want to say, and this is pretty exciting to me and why I love doing this so much, just thinking about The Visitor and going through the movie step by step in my head gave me two other potential 3x3 categories for the future.
Oh, yeah. Well, don't.
And that's something that's very exciting to me, that throughout the week these categories sort of occur to me and I write them down and I get excited about this.
Yeah. I had someone recommend on Quarter to Three, recommend a 3x3. And I said, well, yeah, maybe I'll do that for one of mine, but I realized they're too precious for me. I can't let someone else pick mine. So apologies to Brad Grenz, by the way, because I told him I would use his, and I've completely failed to do that. But if I ever get stuck for a choice, I have one to fall back on that Brad recommended. So dang, I want to change my number one to one of yours, Dingus.
Oh, yours are great.
I might want to steal your number two, Kelly Wand. So my number one, I'm realizing too, looking at mine, none of mine are American movies. Dingus, one of yours is American. Kelly Wand, all three of yours are American. Kelly Wand, you need to see more foreign films.
Yeah. I think Paths of Glory is British.
Oh, good point. Yeah, that's right. He would not leave England, would he, to shoot movies? Well, my number one pick is it's Palestinian. There aren't a lot of these. It's a movie called Paradise Now.
Oh, good one. Yeah.
Which is a Palestinian filmmaker, and he's definitely sympathetic to the cause, if not the methodology that the Palestinians sometimes use. And he's made a movie about two suicide bombers. And it comes back to the whole idea that I approached this list with, that politics is just people. It's an examination. It's fiction. It's a story. It's an examination of the motives that drive these two suicide bombers and what they go through leading up to, I don't want to say the ending, and the ending, again, does this very magical, cool thing that you could not do in an American movie. it's I think, an important perspective that movies should take. It's so easy for us. And at times it makes sense to demonize terrorists, specifically suicide bombers. I wouldn't say I'm pro-Israeli, but I'm more pro-Israeli than I'm pro-Palestinian. Politically speaking, I'm more sympathetic to the situation that Israel's in than what the Palestinians normally do. So for me, it was really, I think, an important thing to see a movie told from a Palestinian perspective about this really complex issue. Even if the movie is a fiction about characters. And I really love that. It reminds me a bit of United 93 opening with the terrorists praying and how I felt watching that. And I'm not sure Paul Greengrass was not – I didn't really need to have the hijackers humanize. That wasn't something I was that interested in, but there was a little touch of that in the movie, and I feel that kind of thing is important. I think it would be very different for somebody who lives in Tel Aviv, for instance, to watch Paradise Now than it is for me living in Los Angeles, reading about that and being able to have an opinion with the luxury of the kind of distance that they don't have in Tel Aviv or in the Gaza Strip. And I feel that that's a really important thing to do in a movie, and I just so appreciated how Paradise Now did that. With these two really incredible characters. There's, Dingus, you and I talk about small character touches in movies, and there's a wonderful moment where these two guys are fitted with their explosive vests and their suits, and they've had to shave their beards off to look like, you know, they're going to infiltrate Israel. They're going to cross one of the checkpoints, and there's a whole support structure. The movie isn't necessarily about the mechanics of suicide bombers as it is about two men who've been sucked into the structure that the Palestinian terrorists use to send suicide bombers into Israel. So there's a point where they're sitting on these dusty rocks waiting on their contact to tell them that they can cross through a gate or whatever. And they get up and they walk across, and one of the men has, they might even be brothers, I forget, one of the men has dust on the back of his jacket, and there's just a lovely moment where the other guy reaches over and brushes the dust off the back of his jacket. Mm. And it's a small moment, but the filmmaker knows it's an important moment, and it's just really a beautiful thing. So that's my number one pick, is it doesn't necessarily humanize terrorists. That's not what it's trying to do, as it shows you a different perspective on a political issue that's really easy to write off with a simple perspective. So that's my number one pick.
I like it too, because the film takes so much time establishing the characters.
Yeah.
And it's really a good 50 minutes of just getting to know them.
Yeah.
And since you mentioned that cool moment that I love, I get to mention a cool moment too from The Visitor.
Please do. Go ahead.
Okay. My favorite little character moment from The Visitor is when Walter is visiting Tariq in the where he's being held, and he's got a letter for Tariq, and he holds it up to the glass and he looks away. There's this great moment where he unfolds the letter and he puts it up and he turns away so he can't read it. And it's this obvious moment of giving this man his privacy when he's in public. And I just loved what that said about Walter's character.
He's extending to him a basic human dignity that's been taken from him.
Right.
It's like a gift he gives him, unconsciously too. It's something that Walter does naturally at that point because of his relationship with Tariq. Yeah. God, right. It's great.
Hey, there's a part in Duck Soup where they sing a silly song and bang some kettles together.
Hey, Kelly, help me out. Is Duck Soup the one where he's on the bed with the crackers, or is that Night at the Opera?
I think that's Room... No, that's Night at the Opera.
That's Animal Crackers.
Animal Crackers.
Oh, right. Animal Crackers, of course.
That's what I meant.
Dingus, you mentioned you were going to pick another... You had another choice instead of 4-3-2 that you were going to pick?
I'm not allowed to say that.
You're not? Well, I'm...
That's curious. Doing a wand.
That is doing a wand, yes. So nobody picked any of the sort of Iraq movies. Like, nobody picked Hurt Locker, or... I guess Generation Kill isn't a movie.
Syriana.
Jarhead.
Of course not.
No, the other film I was thinking of was Lives of Others. I wasn't thinking of any Iraq movies.
Oh, good. Oh, dang, another anti-communist. Dingus, you're like a Reagan-era anti-communist, aren't you?
Yes, yes, I am. Well, that's when I was growing up. I was in a home of conservatism, very conservative at that time in my life.
But see, that's the thing, like 4-3-2 and Lives of Others, that's like Paradise Now. It's an issue on the perspective from inside, and it's a perspective on the issue you don't normally get from where we're
right.
Sitting. And I love that.
And why don't we get it? Propaganda. They got our thing, and we got their thing.
I don't think it's propaganda. I think it's the American film circuit, like Hurt Locker, for instance. Hurt Locker is set in Iraq, and in ways it's about the Iraq War. But Hurt Locker is more Catherine Bigelow exploring her normal issues of male bonding. And she does it in the... I mean, Hurt Locker is basically that... what's the name of the surfing one that I just recently saw?
Dark Star.
Point Break.
Point Break! Good Lord. I can't believe I couldn't remember that. Hurt Locker is basically Point Break. I mean, it's that... It's the same sort of story arc. And I don't say that to demean it. I loved Hurt Locker. But that's an American perspective on the war in Iraq, in a way, sitting in Los Angeles. You guys haven't seen The Messenger, have you?
No, and I really wanted to. Have you seen it?
Yeah, The Messenger's fantastic. And it's another...
crap.
It's another political movie that's not about the politics. It's about people. And it's a different perspective on the Iraq War, and the perspective it offers is just so valuable, and I loved what it did, and it has such unusual character beats. So that's another one that I thought of. But nobody picked Three Kings, for instance.
Nobody picked Crash.
Dingus, you know one that I thought of that I thought you might pick, and it's another one too, where because I picked Bloody Sunday, I thought of this, with James Nesbitt and Liam Neeson, 5 Minutes of Heaven, which is, you could make an argument that it's about the fallout of the Troubles, the situation in Northern Ireland and Britain, but it's clearly a movie about revenge,
right?
And how you approach that, and that's such an important part of politics and why wars unfold, for instance, and national grudges. And I loved that movie. Now I'm just throwing out things I didn't pick, which kind of isn't fair.
But that's okay, because I wanted to talk about The Queen anyway.
Oh, nice. Oh, man, that's a good one. Where can I put this on my list?
Oh, I record all this.
And now that makes me think of Longford.
Oh, good one, yeah.
Oh, my God, which is another one about sort of their story. What's the name of the writer who did The Queen in Longford, Dingus? Do you remember?
No, I can't tell you.
Ah, come on, you can. Please tell
me. He won an Oscar.
Well, anyway, he writes these stories that are presumably about English politics, but instead are very personal topics. And it's the same thing where politics is just people. You know, The Queen is just about how these people deal with the death of Princess Diana. And Longford is about how this one member of Parliament deals with harsh public judgment. God, those are great.
Peter Morgan?
Yes, thank you, Kelly Wong.
Yeah.
You're so smart that you remembered that. Well done.
Thank you.
I watched The Queen recently again, and I really love the relationship and how Helen Mirren handles her dilemma. It's just, if you have not seen The Queen, it is not what you think. It's,
oh my God, Dingus, and now that we're talking about The Queen and Michael Sheen playing the Prime Minister, now I want to talk about Frost Nixon. I'm putting Frost Nixon on my list. Frost Nixon, and I'm crossing out. I can't cross any of these out. Terrible.
By the way, that's another Hans Zimmer score, which made me have to evaluate that he's not a crap head and that I just didn't like the way he did the music or the way the music was mixed in Sherlock Holmes.
You know, I wonder, can you blame him, though? It's sort of like Guy Ritchie comes to him and says, okay, we're doing Sherlock Holmes. Give me something a little different. And so Hans Zimmer plays the music, and what Guy Ritchie does with it, you can't really hold Hans Zimmer accountable for, can you?
I guess not.
He does every movie.
That's kind of true. He should move over and make room for someone else. Yeah.
Like Danny Elfman. That guy doesn't get enough work.
Hey, Juan, is that going to be your 3x3? What composers should get more work?
Nice segue.
Three composers who should get more work. Is that what you're doing next week?
Yeah, John Williams.
He's dead.
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
I'm really out of it.
Stop that.
Wait, is this your transition or are you...
Come on, that was genius. Yeah, don't blow.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hey, yeah, actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, Tom, because my 3x3 topic. Okay. These are three movies where a baby didn't ruin the movie. Because, like, in Look Who's Talking, Shoot 'Em Up, Ghostbusters 2, the baby's just there as a fake threat or a fake thing new, not a threat. Well, I guess in It's Alive, it's a threat and The Omen, but it's a baby that's in jeopardy that, you know, nothing's ever going to happen to it. And the baby always lives. So, yeah, that's my stupid topic.
I love this already, Kelly Wan. So wait, so express.
I have two of mine already ready. So okay, well, do it now.
Give me real quick. Give me the tagline for it again. Just
three movies where a baby didn't ruin the movie.
Good.
Although baby.
Yeah, you're elaborate. Go ahead.
Use more than one baby if you want. Like, okay. If Baby Geniuses is on Tom's list, as I suspect it is, that's acceptable.
This is awesome, and I've already got a couple. I like that a lot, Kelly Wan. Three movies where baby didn't ruin the movie. All right, good.
Are they Stanley the Kubrick films?
See, I thought Dingus wouldn't like this list because he's the father.
I know.
Okay, explain this again. Does the baby have to be in jeopardy, or is the baby...
No, you don't need it explained. He's laid out a great thing. You can run with it. You can game it if you want.
Three movies where the baby didn't ruin the movie.
I mean, you know what it's like, Dingus. All the movies where, oh, the baby's in there. It's obviously in jeopardy. Oh, no, it's not. I mean,
oh, look, babies are in Congress, so we can't blow up Congress.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. Yeah. So I already like this quite a bit, Kelly Wand. Well done.
I thought it was going to be hard, and then I started thinking of a few. So it's actually easier than it looks.
It's good.
And I didn't steal this one, so that's good.
So, and Dingus, what movie should we see next week?
I think we should see that Imaginarium movie.
If you don't know the name of it,
the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
Close. Dr. Sardonicus.
And who directed
it? Dr. Sardonicus, good.
Who directed it?
I think it was John Cleese.
You're terrible. All right, good. So join us next week. We'll be talking about...
Do we have to tease anything else?
The movie that killed Heath Ledger.
Too soon. Also join us for our top 10 list. It'll be a...
I didn't mean it in a mean way.
We'll be posting that the coming week as well.
I meant it in a sad way.
Since these are supposed to be timeless, you know, you could be listening to this long after our top 10 list is relevant.
Oh, well done.
So, if then.
So you know. Otherwise, we will see you in the middle of the week with our top 10 lists.
Oh, God.
See you next week with a discussion of Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. Make sure you've seen it, because otherwise you can't listen or we'll spoil it. And we'll see you when we're here then.
We'll
so
see you at the podcast.
Yes, that was Kelly Wand, and we also have with us Christian Mr. Moronsky? Moronsky?
Marsan.
The underworld, come out of the cupboard, you boys and girls.